Runt of the litter. Size doesn't matter. To a fighter pilot. By Colonel Robert Shorty Rankin, U.S. Air Force retired, as told to and written by James P. Bushka. I was only 5 feet, 4 inches tall when I graduated from flight training in 1943, but my instructor saw something gigantic inside of me. I was one of the 62nd lieutenants selected out of 400 to go into fighters, P-47 Thunderbolts to be exact. But when I first saw the airplanes I would fly in combat, the only thing I thought was, why in the heck did I ask for this behemoth? But after I flew the jug for a while, I really liked it and thought it was a piece of cake to fly. Easy to handle, reliable, and stable. There was nothing out there that could beat the jug in a dive, not even a rock. What I admired most about it, though, were those 8.50 caliber machine guns that stuck out of the wings like great big broom handles. By the time I had arrived in England in 1943, I had 130 hours of P-47 time under my belt, just barely enough to keep me out of trouble. I had great confidence in the airplane and my abilities to fly as a fighter pilot. You had to have these traits because anything else and you were dead. I also had 20/10 vision, so I could usually spot the Luftwaffe before they spotted me. I was posted with the 61st Fighter Squadron of the 56th Fighter Group, the premier P-47 unit of the entire war. I flew with all the great leaders, including Colonel Hub Zemke, Gabby Gabretzky, David Schilling, and the rest. But the person I was most impressed with was Bob Johnson, the first pilot of the European War to break World War I ace Eddie Rickenbacker's record. In my mind, Bob was the best of the whole outfit. He was a gutsy, aggressive, and he would mix it up with Germans as if he didn't have a care in the world. I flew my first combat mission on his wing, and when he spotted the enemy, he turned into me so hard as he went after a PF-109. I lost track of him for a few minutes as I was pushed into a cloud, but I was thrilled to death when I found him again. He increased his score and in turn decreased the Luftwaffe numbers as they were -1/109. I learned a lot from these guys, and eventually I too became a flight leader. I was what you call conservative aggressive. I didn't stick my neck out when I thought it would endanger my wingman. The thing I learned very quickly in combat was regardless of how many airplanes you attack, the leader can usually get through, get a kill or two, and be out of harm's way in a flash. It was the guys following behind him that would get shot down. I flew 75 missions as a flight leader, and I am proud to say that everyone in my flight came home. But it was on a mission on May 12, 1944, that my streak almost came to a crashing halt. We knew through our intelligence people that the Luftwaffe was using very prominent landmarks inside of Germany as a rendezvous point for their scrambled fighters sent up to attack inbound Allied bombers. These Allied bombers, the Germans also used an airborne commander in either a BF-109 or FW-190 to direct the various assembled fighters on what group of bombers to hit. Colonel Hub Zemke, knowing the German tactic, decided that we would do something to outfox the Germans. He called it the Zemke Fan. Colonel Zemke arranged for our group to fly in three very tight formations on a specific track, the same one to be used by the inbound bombers that day, and to fly 45 minutes ahead of the actual bomber stream. The plan was for our group to get there just as the bombers were arriving at their rendezvous point, ready to hit the bombers, which in reality really fooled us. The plan worked so well that the day that the Germans were completely fooled, thinking we were easy prey. I was leading Whipper White Flight in my olive drab P-47 I had named Wicked Whacker Wiggy after my wife. I was leading the westernmost flight of P-47s as we fanned out near Frankfurt when all of a sudden the RT went crazy with people calling out bogeys all over the sky. We were at 25,000 feet when I looked out in front of me. and I saw a great big gaggle of 25 to 35 BF-109s in tight formation, all of them with drop tanks still attached. I ordered my flight to make a beeline for the 109s and press on the attack. They must have seen us coming, because all of a sudden there were drop tanks fluttering and tumbling towards as the 109s split SD into every direction imaginable. I was kind of memorized by the floating drop tanks and the 109 scattering about like chickens. That was until a little voice in my head woke me up. "Hey, what do you think you're doing?" I thought. "Wake up, stupid. Let's get on up there and press on the attack." I quickly latched on to two of the 109s that were heading downhill fast. As I chased after them, the one on my left scooted away from my line of sight, so I concentrated on the right one of our speed as it increased. I had been told long ago that if a 109 pushed over and went straight down, it would not be able to pull the nose out of the jug. So what I did with my attitude is, I can tell you, I went down, I pulled the nose of the jug through the 109 and gave it a quick skirt. With my attitude, I couldn't tell if I hit him or not, but I knew we were building up speed as his wings became to vibrate violently and flutter. I glanced at my airspeed indicator, and I saw the needle passing through 575 miles per hour. Just on the verge of compressibility, I knew it was time to pull out of my dive, but when I pulled back on the sticks with both hands, it felt like it was buried in concrete. The 109 went straight in and disintegrated before burying its remains deep into the ground. I looked at my altimeter and saw that it had hung up at 1,500 feet as I pulled out of the dive, just barely brushing the treetops. I glanced over my shoulder. I saw that my wingman, Lieutenant Cleon Thumpton, had apparently been on his first mission, was still with me. Cleon and I started climbing for altitude, and as we got past 2,000 feet, there were 109 all about itself, flying straight and level, like it was out of a Sunday drive. I pulled right behind him and gave him a hard burst as my rounds tore into his cockpit and engine. The 109 did two violently snap rolls and went straight in. I turned to climb once again, and as I reached 5,000 feet, I heard a call from Colonel Zemke, "Fairbanks leader, I'm 10 miles north of Koblensky, and I'm over the whole Luftwaffe. There's enough here for everybody." I was 15 miles away as I raced to help out. By the time I got to 10,000 feet, I could see the biggest mass of airplanes I had ever laid eyes upon. There were German fighters with big black crosses on their wings, going around in a circle like flies over a piece of meat. I looked up above, and I saw a lone P-47 being flown by Colonel Zemke, hovering over the cloud of German airplanes. Zemke, for whatever reason, was all alone. I knew earlier in that flight that one of his wingmen aborted, so his flight became a flight of three. But where were the other two? It was not until a long time after the war had ended when I found out the answer. I received this information directly from my friend Gunther Rahl, the high-scoring ace, who was also on that mission that day and had his left thumb shot off, before he too was shot down by P-47s of the 56th Fighter Group. Gunther told me that there were almost 90 German fighters orbiting the rendezvous point when the German airborne commander lost his radio. Gunther, who was up on top of his 109, was providing cover for the FW-190s that were going to hit the bombers. Gunther was ordered to go down and take control and command of the assembled fighters. On his way down, Gunther encountered a flight of three P-47s, Zemke's flight, and shot down both wingmen. Zemke pushed his jug over and dove for the deck. Gunther thought that he had got Zemke, too, that day, but he didn't. In fact, after the war, Zemke was able to confirm the two P-47 kills for Gunther, increased his incredible score to 270. Zemke was able to get away from that mess and snuck back above the swirling German fighters. But when I arrived on Zemke's wing, he said to me, "Okay, you're going to cover me when I go down and through them. I'll climb back up and then you can have a... As Zemke dove down, he immediately found a 109 that was climbing towards my altitude, and he tore the 109 apart. That was the first time in combat that I had actually seen a German aircraft engulfed in flame, and I mean, just a huge ball of fire. I had seen plenty of black and white combat films, but this time it was in living color. Now it was my turn to go down. So with Cleon still on my wing, we pushed our jugs over and went looking for something to latch onto without being seen. I made a great big wide orbit, and that was measured in miles as I descended, looking for my next prey. It didn't take long, and I spotted two 109s 50 feet apart. I looked around and saw that Cleon was still with me, and I felt as though I could now go get the two without getting my tail shot off. Behind the one on the left and gave him a quick burst. The 109 began to smoke right after his right landing gear flopped down and he rolled over in a slow spiral. I eased over behind the other 109 by using some right rudder and the guy didn't move. There was no evasive action whatsoever from this guy. Maybe he was in shock seeing his leader shot down, or maybe he never saw me. Whatever the case, I gave him a short burst, and the same thing happened. His right gear flopped down, his engine was pouring out smoke, and he too went down in a spiral. Both 109s stayed together, not too far apart, as they headed down in their death spiral. That was number 3 and 4 for the day, but I was far from over. I was turning and climbing, and at the same time getting myself cleared again, when I saw 109 climbing right underneath Colonel Zemke. I called to Zemke, "Fairbanks, break hard left." Zemke called back and asked, "Where is it?" I replied, "He's climbing right up under your ass." Oh boy, I thought, he's going to get me for that poor RT procedure when I get back from this one. At the same time, I maneuvered in behind the 109 and gave him a quick skirt from my guns. I saw some hitting route and canopy area, and I went to squeeze the trigger, and again, nothing, just some clicking noise. Oh, I didn't think I hit him enough to do any damage, but I was tickled to death when the guy eased off to the right, popped his canopy. Although I had shot down 5 aircraft, I was not about to start celebrating. I was a long way from home, out of ammo, and without any lights to speak of flying nearby. Cleon, thankfully, was still there with me as he turned for England. Trouble was, two 109s blocked our way as they came in for an attack. All 4 of us went into a Lufbery circle as he went round and round. One of the 109s was gaining on Cleon, so I told him to break down and out of the circle, climb back up and get behind them. Well, with Cleon's lack of experience, he didn't quite follow directions. He came back down all right. Problem was, he was right in front of a 109. He got out of there by the skin of his teeth and tried it again. Same thing. On his 3rd attempt, he broke down, and when he came back up, one of the 109s went head-to-head with him. Cleon let him have it, as they were nose-to-nose. Shooting down an airplane is hard enough, but shooting one down head-to-head is one tough shot, even for an experienced pilot. Cleon sure experienced a lot on that mission and got his first victory, head-on. In the meantime, I was stuck in the circle with the other 109, who I am sure had plenty of ammo. I even got right behind him, dead astern, only 40 feet away from chewing his tail off. It was probably a smart move on my part when I told Cleon to break hard and head west as the 109 was still heading east in his turn. As we increased our speed and distance from the 109, I pulled my chart out and spread it across my lap, looking for the best place to cross the channel. I was sweating it because I knew that the wingmen were always short on fuel than the leader because of all the throttle adjustments they had to mind to stay in with me. I had my head down inside the cockpit and froze for a second when Cleon called me and said, "Break." I quickly answered him and asked, "Fighters or flak?" Luckily, it was only flak, but the problem we were only at Port Little, territory. I couldn't afford to waste precious fuel by climbing, so we just made some heading changes. I looked back and saw the puffs of flak burst where I would have been if I had kept it straight. The anti-aircraft gunners couldn't keep up and with us as we zigzagged home. I looked up ahead and I saw the North Sea, and I knew we were almost home. At the same time, I saw a huge gaggle of airplanes on a conversion intercept, right on the same course I was on. All I could think of was, after all we've been through, what in blazes is going to happen now? So I relaxed when I saw it was a flight of P-47s in close formation. When they flew like that over enemy territory, I will never know. And I didn't care at the time. So we crossed the channel. We pointed our noses for the long, wide runway at RAF Manson and touched down on British soil. On the rollout, I taxied off the runway, but Cleon was nowhere to be found. He had run out of fuel when he touched down and was stuck on the runway. I ran into the British operations building while they towed Cleon back in and called back to the 56th FG headquarters. Zemke was laughing and beside himself when he got on the phone and told me what he had informed the rest of the pilots. We won't be seeing Rankin and Thornton again. They got themselves bottled up and there were just too many German airplanes around. There was no way they were going to get out of that big mess. He had written us off. He told me to get back to base and he would hold the rest of the pilots so I could give the debrief. When Cleon and I arrived back at our base, there was a lot of handshaking and applauding as he critiqued the mission. The 56 got 19 enemy airplanes that day, and I received a big reward from Colonel Zemke for shooting down 5 109s. Colonel Zemke announced to all my fellow squadron mates, "Make sure Rankin gets a whole chicken at the officers' mess tonight." I was happy I got 5 that day, but I was even more delighted to be sharing my chicken with my wingman that night. Bob Rankin ended the war with 10 victories, all of them BF-109s, and all of them in the P-47 Thunderbolts. His last victory was one day after D-Day, June 7, 1944. Look for Robert Rankin's book. He is writing about his life and times in FG Wolfpack.